Hello everyone and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 367. This week the questions are taken from just two videos, guide 434 on HMS Glowworm and the Wednesday video on USS Slater, Albany's destroyer escort. So let's get on with questions. BK Zhong asks, you've discussed in earlier videos that Glowworm's last stand had the unintended result of misleading British intelligence as to German intentions, resulting in the Germans being able to land in Norway largely unopposed. Would this have changed if Glowworm had managed to report that the German destroyers she'd engaged were carrying troops? Well, the big question, of course, would be how would they be able to report that? Because, yes, in theory, you could spot some of the supplies on deck and maybe even some of the troops if they hadn't taken cover, but you'd have to be quite close to do so, and in the rough weather visibility was even worse than it normally would be in that kind of situation. So it's questionable as to if it could be done, but if we hand wave that side and say, I don't know, maybe there was a really, really thick patch of fog and Glowworm popped out, you know, 500-600 yards away from a German destroyer, took a look and went, oh my goodness, that's troops and supplies and it's very heavily laden, and then ran into another patch of fog before either side could do much more than that. And Glowworm was then able to go, hey, hang on a minute, I've run into a couple of German destroyers. They appear to be heavily loaded with supplies on their decks and potentially carrying troops. That could make things very different because, of course, the big home fleet deployment headed out to sea, thinking it was going to intercept a major German breakout into the Atlantic. But if they're told, actually, some of these ships at least are carrying troops, well, that would play into the whole the Germans might be going after Norway thing. Now, of course, they did have some other conflicting intel from things like aerial recon reports that had gotten what they'd seen slightly wrong, or had only seen parts of the German formations and so forth. But if we assume that someone took this report seriously because, hey, well, you know, this theoretical spotting took place at a few hundred yards by multiple people rather than a few miles by an aircraft, then, yeah, it's not going to stop all the German landings, particularly the more southerly groups, the one that goes after Oslo and so forth. They're far too close to their objective at this point, and the Royal Navy can't really go that far south to counter them without some significant air support. But certainly the attacks on Narvik and the other ports along the west Norwegian coast could potentially have been stopped. And who knows, if the right set of circumstances had come about, then maybe even Scharnhorst and Eisenhower would have been intercepted by the home fleet, which would have put their careers to a rather short finish, because you'd be talking about either Renown and Repulse or possibly Hood, because Hood was out there as well, all three. Obviously, the Renown's overcovering the mine-laying expedition, but you can guarantee if they're told, hey, there's a bunch of German ships coming that way, after Renown and Repulse have finished off the destroyers, they might head to link up with elements of the home fleet, of which Hood, being a fast ship, would be an obvious one, to try and hunt down Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. Kendra Malm asks, the British letter-class destroyers often get such interesting or odd names. What's your favourite names from these ships? Honestly, I like the ones that are just somewhat random. You know, it's like someone had either had a long night or was very, very drunk when they selected those particular names, especially when you look at them in the context of the other classes. I mean, there's a huge sway of that across all Royal Navy destroyer names, like this somewhat older one, HMS Quail, which is just great. It's like it's this small, inoffensive round puffball in amidst, you know, her sister ship is the Sparrowhawk, and then there's Quail. But in specifically the interwar letter classes, some of my favourite ones are the Anthony, because, yeah, when you're in a class that's got things like Ardent, Active, Arrow, Acheron, well, here's Anthony. The C&D class offer quite a few good ones. So in the C class, admittedly, it's a small run, but you've got Comet, Crusader, Signet, you know, a little baby swan. And then The D class is also a little bit weird. I mean, Duncan, you might think, oh, that's a name, but, you know, Admiral Duncan, fair enough. But then you've got Defender, Diamond, Dingty, Decoy. Yeah, let's all go and serve on HMS Decoy, lads. To be fair, the E and F classes, generally their names are just pretty good, solid names. Although the fact that you could potentially go on escapade along with escort leaves you with all sorts of wonderful double entendres. And you do occasionally run into some rather amusing ones that are just very in your face, like the H class has hostile. You know, I wonder what they were going for with that one. You also have some rather funny names that apropos of what actually happened to them. Like you have Grenade. Shockingly, Grenade was gone by 1940. But then on the other hand, you have Impulsive. And, well, they must have let some Impulsive thoughts win because Impulsive actually survived the war to be scrapped afterwards. Which, you know, isn't a bad feat considering most of the I-class got sunk. Warrant Officer Will asks, why didn't Britain build up more substantial naval yards and other facilities in Canada? I'm under the impression that despite being a much larger place with far more resources, the Royal Navy's infrastructure across the entirety of Canada was less than the capacity of Gibraltar. Is this true, or has the perpetual underfunding of the Canadian Navy that's been going on after this channel's cutoff date given a false impression? Well, Canada's naval capacity in terms of infrastructure versus Gibraltar is kind of six or one half dozen of the other. Yes, actually, the Gibraltar naval base probably has greater naval infrastructure than Canada does for a lot of the period the channel covers for capital ship anchorage and maintenance. However, Gibraltar doesn't really have the capability of building much, whereas Canada can. So in some ways, Canada has more infrastructure than Gibraltar. In other ways, perhaps not so much. But the fundamental issue here is that, yes, if you look at a map of the British Empire, population, resources, etc., it makes perfect sense to expand your shipbuilding out into Canada to maximise potential. And indeed, that was one of the many ideas put forward by the people who wanted to form an imperial federation in the latter part of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. However, two things come into play. Firstly, just how many ships do you want in the Royal Navy? Because Britain had quite a lot of shipbuilding capacity in and of itself already. And as I mentioned several times before, even in the middle of the pre-dreadnought and dreadnought races of the 1900s and 1910s, you still had British shipyards crying out for work. And that was with a major naval arms race with Germany going on and building warships for half a dozen other countries. So what more would you build in Canada? Unless Britain was really turning imperialism up to 11, which is possible, you know. But the other big issue, which is perhaps a much larger one, even if Britain had wanted to go full imperial and, you know, do a 2 or 3 to 1 standard against everybody, is that Canada had been made a dominion in the late 1860s. And that essentially meant that Canada, to a large extent, was self-governing in pretty much all respects other than foreign policy. And that, of course, means that after 1867, Britain can't just turn around and say, hey, Canada, we're going to build a bunch of shipyards and dry docks and slipways and gun foundries and blah, blah, blah in Canada, because the Canadian government can say, oh, hang on a minute, I'm not necessarily sure I want all of that. Because, well, you might be thinking, well, why wouldn't they want all of this? Well, apart from anything, if you suddenly start building massive amounts of naval infrastructure in Canada, some people in the United States might be going, oh, hang on a minute, why exactly are they doing that? Because for Britain, a lot of its naval infrastructure on that side of the Atlantic was further down in the Caribbean, because that was far more central, therefore made more sense for managing what was at that point the West Indies and North America station. But if you build up lots of naval infrastructure in Canada, then it's only really one of two things. It's either sending lots of ships back over to the UK, or it's specifically building up to fight the USA. And of course, the more panicky senators in the USA will think it's building up for a war. So, you know, in order to not escalate hostilities unnecessarily, the Canadian government might say no. And prior to 1867, the simple fact is that, well, Canada didn't have a particularly large population. So at the time when population is large enough and resource extraction is advanced enough to, on paper, merit perhaps vastly expanding Canadian shipyard capacity, it's politically not necessarily a great move, and also Britain doesn't actually have the direct political control to do it, even if they wanted to. Simon Valente asks, Dear Drac, when are you going to Chatham Docks next? Anyone else in the mood for a visit to Chatham? I'm relatively flexible on that point outside of other prior travel commitments, so maybe, well, we've done a Portsmouth visit with subscribers and kind of a tour and everything, so maybe I should set the next one up for Chatham and maybe put a poll up to see what day people want to go. Probably, I would imagine, a Saturday, but we shall see. Deeks25 asks, While taking nothing away from Glowworm's last stand and Roop's conduct during the battle with Hipper, I've often wondered if Roop was a little overzealous in trying to chase down two German destroyers that individually outmassed and outgunned Glowworm. I know Royal Navy destroyer captains were an applaudably aggressive breed, and I refer to a lot of destroyers as having angry small ship syndrome, but would he have been better served shadowing them and radioing their position? Or is this engaging in armchair hindsight? It's a little bit of a difficult one, because with the visibility conditions prevalent at the time, shadowing probably isn't going to work. If you have nice, clear, calm conditions, then shadowing definitely can work, obviously bearing in mind this is pre-radar. So at that stage, yeah, following them to see what they're up to might be a good idea. But in the visibility and weather conditions prevalent at that point, to be in visual range of the target is also to be, approximately speaking, in gun range. And since the Germans aren't going to really pay that, you know, kind of a favour to you just following them around, they're going to shoot at you, at which point you will need to shoot back or withdraw. And if you are going to end up in a shooting match, well, as you said, you're outmassed and outgunned by either one of the German destroyers. So in a straight-up fight where you sort of sail nicely in parallel to each other, you should, by all metrics, lose. Whereas if you are a British destroyer captain and you see this kind of situation, your first thought is, if I attack really, really aggressively, I can probably get the first shots off. I can potentially, therefore, get the first hits in. And if I can absolutely hammer my first target to the point that it's not really capable of fighting back, then I've created a problem for my opponent, because either he has to drop back and assist his stricken compatriot, in which case it makes him a more easy target for my guns, or he has to fight on and leave his stricken compatriot behind, which increases the chances of the stricken ship being killed and in either or sinking. And in either case, I'm only fighting one. And if I really hammer my first target, there's also a possibility the other one might look and see, well, hang on a minute, theoretically, I'm bigger than him, but so was the other guy, and he died in the last 5 minutes. Maybe I should skedaddle. So, faced with the situation Roop was in, given his knowledge of the situation, bear in mind, all he knows is he's run into a couple of German destroyers, then going all-out attack mode was actually probably the best bet for the knowledge he had at that point. Now, if he'd had access to some more intel and perhaps known that there was either known or suspected to be a large German formation, perhaps with multiple destroyers and maybe one or two heavier ships, then he might have tried something slightly different. But he doesn't know that until Hipper rocks up, by which point it's a little bit too late. Chris B asks, Do you know if the letter Heyer wrote to the Royal Navy still exists? I honestly don't actually know. It should still exist because it went through the Red Cross. So the Red Cross theoretically might have a copy of it. And then it went to the Royal Navy, and then it was used as part of the consideration for Roop's Victoria Cross. So there would have been multiple chances to either copy it or archive it. But in terms of what exactly it says, etc., I wasn't able to find it directly referenced in the Kew National Archives site. So whether or not the original still exists and or where it is, I'm not entirely sure. If anyone else knows, please chime in the comments below. Bastu Gubar asks, I was playing Ultimate Admiral Dreadnoughts just now, and I thought for a bit about the damage instability debuff a ship can get. In short, when a ship is damaged, the aim of its guns will be made worse. The name of the debuff would imply the hull has become less stable. Other than the obvious case of a fire control station or a radar being knocked out or a crew being killed or wounded, is there any real or historical basis in such a statistic where just by the ship being damaged, its gunnery becomes less accurate? Yep, that is definitely a thing, although obviously it depends where you are hit, because if you're hit amidships on the superstructure and that doesn't, you know, directly affect a rangefinder or something in the nearby vicinity, then you're unlikely to really impair a ship's capability of firing back with its main armament. But damage instability suggests that there's a degree of flooding going on. And at that point, yes, you absolutely can suffer inaccuracy to your gunnery without your gunnery or your fire control systems themselves being hit. And that's for a number of reasons. Firstly, of course, if you are hit on the waterline or below the waterline or somewhere in such a way that it allows flooding in, then some of your systems may now give somewhat inaccurate readings. So how are you measuring your speed, for example? If one of your speed measurements is coming from the RPM of your engines, well, if, say, you've taken a big hit up front and your bow is down, your engines might be going at quite a high RPM, but you might not be making all that much progress. And similarly, if you've got some kind of pitot tube or equivalent that's measuring the speed of the water coming past, if you've disrupted the water flow past the ship because there's jagged bits of hull sticking out, or that sensor is now much deeper or at a different angle, perhaps partly shielded by an angled hull now, that could be giving false reading. So that's going to mess with your fire control system because it's not getting the right inputs. Another factor to take into account, specifically with the term of instability, is that once you take water on board, you're affecting the overall trim of the ship and how it reacts to the water. So if you take a bunch of flooding up front, your ship is bow down, you're much more likely to plunge heavily and come up more slowly. Now, of course, how the turret, assuming you've got some kind of tracking going on once you've locked on, that is going, if it's automatic, is going to be either thrown out slightly, or if it can compensate, it's going to have a much harder time compensating. Or if you're doing it manually, again, it's going to be harder, because if you're pitching normally, there'll be a certain rhythm to it. If you're pitching very heavily because you've got flooding at the bow or the stern, you're going to have a lot more pitch one way and a lot less the other. And that's harder to anticipate and compensate for. Plus, of course, water moves around. Similarly, if you have a hit to port or starboard and you're listing that way, not only is that going to rule out certain elevations for your gunnery, but again, it means your rate of roll is going to be slightly off. And as the water sloshes around inside the ship, it's also no longer going to be a steady roll. It's going to be somewhat juddery, which, regardless of if you've got manual or automatic tracking for the guns, is going to make things much, much more difficult in terms of keeping the guns on target. And that'll be mostly caused by free surface effect. So if you want a basic demonstration, obviously ships are compartmentalized, but to give some idea, if you get a large plastic box and somewhat fill it with water and put it in a tub, a big, like a bathtub or a swimming pool or something, maybe make some waves outboard of it, then if when the tub is empty, when your box is empty, the box will have a rhythm to it that is proportional to the waves. If you've got some water in it, so a couple of inches worth, maybe 2-3 inches, and you give it a bit of a shake up, and then you subject it to waves from the outside, you'll notice that it's a very haphazard motion, because the wavelength of the waves outside and the sloshing about of the water inside are not connected. And so it'll dance and wiggle and everything, and that'll make it much, much harder to be stable, which, of course, for a ship means less accurate gunnery. Panzersverg asks, what does an aircraft carrier need to be able to support jet aircraft, i.e. what special equipment or construction retrofits are needed for carriers to make the switch from piston engine to jet aircraft? So, some of the things you definitely need. Strong and relatively long flight decks. And if you don't have strong flight decks, you're going to need some reinforcement. That's partly because jet aircraft just tend to weigh somewhat more than previous generation piston engine aircraft, but also the speed and temperature of the air that's coming out of their jets is going to be considerably, you know, faster and hotter than air being pushed by propellers aboard aircraft. And so you need the decks strengthened and heat resistant to withstand the force of the aircraft's engines themselves as they try and take off or land. Because remember, when you land, you keep the throttle fully open until you're absolutely sure you've caught the arrestor wire, because otherwise you could end up in the drink. Related to that, obviously, you need a catapult, because especially when you're transitioning from piston to jet aircraft, early jet aircraft, the jet engines spool up very, very slowly compared to the spool up of piston engine aircraft heading up to full power. So unlike a propeller aircraft, you can't just kind of sit roughly halfway down the flight deck, push the throttle to full and get enough airspeed to get airborne. You also tend to have higher takeoff speeds and landing speeds anyway, but even if it was the same, you wouldn't get to the same speed in the same distance. So you need a catapult to help the aircraft on its way. That would be your absolute minimum. Of course, with higher landing speeds, you might want better assistance for the pilots coming in, you know, reflector landing systems and so forth. You might also want bigger hangars, because obviously as jet aircraft get bigger, they tend to need more space. But as demonstrated here with this Sea Venom, and yes, it is operating off a US aircraft carrier in this instance, the Sea Venom is kind of evidence that you don't necessarily need massive hangars to operate modern jet aircraft. You also might need to improve the size and or load capacity of your aircraft elevators, again, to support bigger, heavier aircraft. Reading Railroad Fan asks, Admiral Lutyens had orders not to engage heavy units unless absolutely necessary. Would Bismarck have been in a better position if Lutyens had gone after Norfolk and Suffolk, and would this have prevented the Battle of the Denmark Strait and Bismarck breaking out into the Atlantic? No, in fact, as weird as it might sound, going after Norfolk and Suffolk would probably have been one of the worst decisions Lutyens could have gone for. Because simply put, Norfolk and Suffolk were faster than he was, and they had radar. So if he turns around and starts coming back at them, they're going to see him coming, as in fact did actually happen once or twice. And that means that Norfolk and Suffolk can just go, okay, we'll turn around and ramp up to speed, and, well, you can't catch us. Maybe you'll get in range for a few experimental long-range salvos, but you're very, very unlikely to actually be able to do anything about us. And the problem there is, well, severalfold. Firstly, you're wasting ammunition. Secondly, you're wasting fuel, which you've got a very limited supply of, because obviously running at high speed to even try and catch them is going to burn a lot of fuel. Thirdly, you're also losing time and distance, because every time you double back to go after Norfolk and Suffolk and perhaps engage in a prolonged chase before you give up and start heading back into the Atlantic, you're essentially resetting distance that you've already covered. And in fact, you're doubly making things worse for yourself, because not only are you not making forward progress, you're regressing back eastwards, which means you now have to make up all that ground you just covered before you're back at square one, which, apart from the fuel issue, also gives the rest of the Royal Navy more time to catch up. The other thing is, if you're constantly trying to chase after Norfolk and Suffolk, well, Norfolk and Suffolk are going to know exactly where you are. And given that the night engagement that Admiral Holland had planned, so Hood and Prince of Wales running in right close at night with half a dozen destroyers in support and presumably Norfolk and Suffolk as well, the only reason that didn't come about was because Suffolk managed to lose contact with Bismarck at long range the previous day. Well, this time that doesn't happen. So if the British heavy cruisers are going, yep, we're being chased by Bismarck, this is perfect, please come to us, we are here, Bismarck's there, then, well, technically we probably would have prevented the historic Battle of the Denmark Strait, but it also would have been curtains for Bismarck, because then as we know, Bismarck managed to disable its own radar with its gunfire. So, yeah, instead of the longish, medium to long range engagement that we get historically, where the range is closing somewhat slowly and Hood gets blown up, what instead is going to happen, most likely, is that Admiral Holland's task force is going to come barreling in out of nowhere, closing at a much faster rate, probably with the destroyers leading. And so Bismarck and Prince Eugen, the first thing they're probably going to know is, hey, there's a bunch of destroyers coming out of nowhere and attacking us, and there's torpedoes, and oh, good Lord, we need to dodge, while firing back at the destroyers. It's very possible they may be hit by one or more torpedoes at that point, but while they're in the middle of our high-speed dodge and pursuit, you can guarantee the destroyers will be lobbing star shells at them, at which point that gives Hood, Prince of Wales, Norfolk and Suffolk the perfect marker to work themselves into position and then move in for an attack. And as we know, you know, with the final battle of Bismarck, county-class heavy cruiser fire can do some damage to Bismarck, let alone Prince Eugen. And in this case, you're going to have all the British ships with working radar. Even Hood had radar, believe it or not. And although which ship's gun radar is more or less useful for gunnery is a slightly different matter. But nonetheless, you've got night-trained British ships with radar to point them in the direction they need to go. Of course, Norfolk and Suffolk have their own torpedoes. Hood also has its torpedoes. And they're all going to be able to pull off a Matapan-style pincer manoeuvre. It's not going to end well for the Germans 9 times out of 10. Burnett asks, why did the US Navy decide to not continue development of the 13-inch naval gun from some of their pre-dreadnoughts? Something like a 13-inch 45 caliber gun would have been a very interesting thing to see on the South Carolina class. Basically, wait. The 12-inch 40 caliber, which was the 1335's successor, offered substantially better penetration at a reasonable reduction in weight for the gun, although the turrets weighed about the same, but that's more to do with the level of protection on the turrets than anything else. So, given the constraints that Congress was putting on the US Navy at the time, you know, trying to limit the absolute tonnage of battleships, and we're very similar actually to French practice at that point, developing a 13-inch 45 caliber gun, roughly speaking, doing the maths based on the two guns' relative densities, would have ended up with you in a position where you could theoretically have a 13-inch 45 gun, but just weight based on the gun weight alone, you'd be looking at 3 13-inch 45 caliber guns having about the same weight as 4 12-inch 40s. And then you take into account the slightly larger turret, the additional heavy weight of the mounting system for the guns, because obviously it's got to deal with more recoil and more weight of the gun itself. Bigger and heavier ammunition, therefore less ammunition, unless you make the ship larger, therefore overall increased tonnage of the ship, regardless of the individual weight of the guns and the turrets. And suddenly your ship is going to either have to be substantially larger, which Congress isn't going to let you do, or you're going to have to sacrifice other features of the ship. And at that point, the US Navy is just about beginning to get true ocean-going pre-dreadnoughts as opposed to somewhat glorified coast defense battleships. And if they've got a hard tonnage limit and they can't really sacrifice too much on speed without becoming laughingstocks, they'd essentially have to stick with glorified coast defense ships, sacrificing fuel and other things to give yourself the displacement you need for these bigger guns, or perhaps sacrificing a secondary battery or a good chunk of it. And ultimately, at the battle ranges they were expecting to fight at the time they developed the 12-inch 40, the 12-inch 40 has more than enough penetration to punch through most other ships' protection. So why compromise the rest of your design with a bigger gun that has essentially at that point unnecessarily large amounts of penetration? Oscar Lamuela asks, with many anti-aircraft or dual-purpose guns like the 40mm Bofors, the Japanese 25mm, etc., gun laying is split between one person who does the horizontal training and another who controls vertical aiming. How did they coordinate between each other? Would one train on a target and the other would guess at which point the first meant to fire on? I assume yelling orders or pointing all over the guns firing wouldn't be too helpful. Did they have an appointed gun director of sorts? It really depends on whether you have range finding and fire control information coming from some kind of external system, you know, an anti-aircraft fire control director, for instance. Now, obviously, once you get RPC, remote power control, it's rather academic. But assuming that you're in a period where you're still hand cranking, if you've got external reference data from some kind of anti-aircraft fire control system, then it'll be a case of things will be pointing where you need to go, and therefore you go there. So it'll be telling the guy on the vertical crank, you need to depress the guns to this point and then keep depressing them at this rate. And they'll be doing the same thing for the guy on the horizontal. So they're just essentially doing a follow the pointer system. If, however, you're acting under completely local control, independent of anything else, and you don't really have any rangefinder systems going on other than the Mark I human eyeball, then you're relying somewhat on your training to estimate where you should be aiming. That's why you've got those multi-ring gun sights. And yes, the anti-aircraft gun emplacements each would have a gun captain or equivalent rank, basically someone in charge of the mounting. And if necessary, they would be indicating some estimation of what was happening. So, if, you know, if there's three or four Japanese torpedo bombers coming in at you and you're mounting 40mm Bofors like this one, although this is a somewhat later model, then your gun captain might say, you know, I don't know, four Japanese aircraft at 7 o'clock, so presumably you're on the port side, engage right-handmost aircraft or engage aircraft on this bearing or however he wants to say it. Or if he's got a pointy stick, point at the aircraft and say, that aircraft, at which point it's down to the two people in charge of the cranking to start estimating things. Because the thing is, both men will have some degree of estimation as to, or some degree of knowledge as to what the other one has to do. So it won't be a case of, let's say the aircraft is coming bow to stern, so right to left from the perspective of the gunners, at a slight down angle, let's say a 20 degree down angle, because he's diving in to prepare his torpedo attack. The guy who's on the horizontal crank isn't going to be just doing a perfect horizontal lead as if he's flying straight and level, because he can see he's not flying straight and level. He knows that there's going to be a certain amount of depression going on there, so he'll be shortening his lead very slightly, and then that means the guy who's on the vertical, he doesn't have to worry so much about the horizontal lead. He's just got to worry about making sure the tracking is fine for the vertical element, and then in theory, you're roughly in the ballpark. This is why it's important to cross-train and why anti-aircraft gunners will get the full experience. Or, you know, not just, hey, your specialism is cranking this gun up and down and that is all you're ever going to do. Simon Valente asks, Drac, taking inspiration from your directing skills, is there a naval history film that should be made and that you'd love to direct? If so, what would the film be about and from whose point of view? So, my top four naval history films that I think should be made, and if I could get a chance to direct, I'd love to, actually all have very different styles, if you like, and each one reflects how I think each battle would best be presented. So one would be the Battle of Samar. The Battle of Samar I would present more as a very personal story, and focusing mainly on personal courage and decision-making. So you would be somewhat looking at Admiral Kurita and Admiral Halsey, but they are more kind of background pieces in that they are setting the scene for why this is happening. But for the actual battle itself, which would be obviously the main part of the film, I would be focusing on Captain Evans, of course, on USS Johnston. And I'd use Johnston as the kind of the center ship. Much as obviously you've got Howell and Samuel B. Roberts there as well, the fact is that there are museum ships, specifically ships like Kidd out there, that could very, very easily be used to substitute in for Johnston, being a Fletcher class, and thus you could get the most accurate filming aboard. And so as well as Evans, I would identify maybe two or three other people who would be your center characters, you know, maybe Gunner, that kind of thing. And most of the film would be fairly tight focus on them, what they're doing, why they're doing it, the amount of courage it took for them to do what they did, and the battle is kind of the backdrop to what they've accomplished. Next up would be Jutland. Jutland would be almost completely the inverse. Jutland would be a story about the fleets, the grand strategy, the odds that were at stake. So I'd actually open a Jutland movie with a section about the front lines on the Western Front to give an idea of what is at stake here, what's going on in the world. Maybe do a little montage as well, showing things like Gallipoli and the Falkland Islands, Dogger Bank, etc. But that wouldn't take very long. It'd probably be mostly CGI. But for Jutland, as I said, would be much more about, you know, big sweeping shots of the ships and so forth. And you'd have a kind of, not necessarily an all-star cast, but a very wide cast. So obviously you'd have to have Jellicoe, Beatty, Hipper, and Shear as your sort of primary focal characters, so that you can get an idea of what decisions are being made by who and why, and that's explaining why the fleets are doing this, that, and the other. But I would also go through a lot of accounts from Jutland where various sailors have said what's going on, pick out key things that they describe, and basically focus on somebody playing that person in that place on that ship at that time to show kind of the general gist of what's going on all over the place. You know, so for example, you know, you'd have to have at least a brief sequence at some point that shows that the future king is in fact serving aboard HMS Colossus, and then at some point in the future during the action show that shell that comes spinning over the top of Colossus's turret where the future king is. So those would be my two candidates for serious film. And then in the slightly less serious, I mean, still historically accurate to a degree, but much more artistic license taken, I would do the Battle of Quiberon Bay, which is why you've got this picture up here, because I absolutely love the Battle of Quiberon Bay. No surprise to those of you who've seen this channel before. But I would play that still somewhat realistic, but with artistic license more on the towards the sort of Pirates of the Caribbean original trilogy type theme. So sort of slightly larger than life characters, very big set pieces. I mean, the weather at Quiberon Bay scarcely needs artistic license, but you can amp it up a little bit just for a bit of fun. A lot of the stuff that went on, it's that kind of thing of reality is actually sometimes stranger and more unbelievable than fiction could be. And yes, before you ask, I absolutely am getting Geoffrey Rush to play Admiral Hawke. And then the final one would be, which would probably be the most heavily stylized, would be the Battle of Lepanto. It's got politics, it's got scheming, it's got backstabbing, it's got big fleets, it's got, you know, once the battle is actually joined, it's got loads of gunfire, it's got ships literally falling apart, people being dumped into the sea, huge amounts of melee fighting, firearms and going off left, right and center, and again some rather lunatic stuff developing as the battle goes on. So I would actually be filming that in the style of the movie 300. Michael Johnston asks, why don't many American museum ships whose period of interpretation is strictly World War II or earlier fly era-appropriate flags? Is it against flag code, or is it just as simple as they don't think to do that? Do other ships internationally do similar things? I don't know exactly what the circumstances are with US ships, museum ships, and their flag code overall, obviously not being American. So if someone does know in more detail, then feel free to chime in below. But for some of them, at least, I can offer some explanation. So, for example, USS Constitution is still a commissioned warship in the US Navy, so I believe at that point she has to fly the current US flag. Of course, at the time that she was commissioned, there would have been a lot fewer stars on the US flag, but the commissioned warship must, I'm pretty sure, fly the current flag. As a sort of example, similarly, the Royal Navy kind of has a little bit of an out on that one, because Victory, while still commissioned and obviously also flying the current flag, but she flies a white ensign, and a white ensign was also a valid flag at the time she was in commission. Although, interestingly, Warrior, which is obviously somewhat later than Victory, she's not a commissioned warship anymore, and she actually flies the red ensign, which nowadays is the flagship of the British Merchant Navy. But at the time that Warrior was launched, the red ensign was still a valid Royal Navy ensign, so she is actually flying a historical flag. But I think another factor might just be cost, because flags are, in fact, a consumable item, especially in some of the places where the US Museum ships are. They will get shredded relatively swiftly by the winds, or at least damaged to a point where it's probably no longer appropriate to fly them. And of course, you can bulk buy modern US flags, whereas if you want a very specific, I don't know, a 48 star flag or something like that, that's going to be a special order item. So that's going to cost more. Museum ships do have something of a bottom line to consider. And so while they might fly a specific era appropriate historical flag for very specific occasions, I suspect for the majority of the time, it's just simpler and easier to fly the current US flag because it's going to be a heck of a lot cheaper. And for some ships, I think it would also be a very difficult decision about which flag to fly. So, for example, a good example would be USS Olympia. So if you want her to fly a historic flag, do you fly a flag that shows her at the time that she was commissioned, in which case you would have a 44-star flag, thanks to the admission of Wyoming in 1890, or are you going to have her fly a flag from her most famous period, the Spanish-American War, because that would be a 45-star flag, because between her commissioning and the Spanish-American War, Utah joins in 1896. Or if she's, at the moment, obviously, she's shown in her early format with the twin 8-inch turrets, but if she were to be updated to her World War I standard with a single 5-inch at either end, and perhaps you're saying, well, if she's now portraying the time period when she brings the unknown soldier back, well, now you need a 48-star flag because New Mexico and Arizona join in 1912. And so you'd need a 48-star flag at that point. And then in theory, all the World War II ships should be flying 48-star flags. But obviously, you have things like the Iowas and some of the destroyers that were then in service later on, you know, and if they were in service past 1959, when Alaska joins, then it's a 49-star flag. And if it's actually past 1959, then you'd potentially also have a 50-star flag. And there's like a 1-year gap, I think, where you can have a 49-star flag. But, you know, for the Iowas or Midway, for example, or even Lexington, stuff like that, then in theory, they could fly a 48-star flag or a 50-star flag, or for some bizarre reason, a 49-star flag. Which ones do you choose? And of course, the 50 is the current one. The Rogue Chief asks three closely related questions involving Royal Navy ship naming conventions. So we'll answer each one as we go through the question. First, why doesn't the Royal Navy have more ships named for heroic naval figures like the US Navy often does? The only British ships with personal names seem to be monarchs and higher-ranking admirals or generals. Surely a force with a much longer and more storied legacy wouldn't be short of ordinary sailing men worth getting a ship named for them. Is it a matter of royal versus republican norms? Not so much. I think it's more a matter of where in the hierarchy of ships the Royal Navy, at least until very recently, tends to place ships named for particular individuals. So in the US Navy, the, if you like, upper tiers of ships are already taken. You know, battleships get state names, cruisers get city or county names, and then you're down to basically the destroyers. And there's lots of destroyers, so destroyers tend to get, you know, a class named after someone fairly famous, you know, Fletcher, Farragut, Sims, etc. And then the individual destroyers get named after various, you know, Medal of Honor recipients, or if they were even before the Medal of Honor, people who were very well known in the Navy. And if you've got very large numbers of ships, like destroyers, you need a pool of large numbers of people to call on. So it makes sense to draw from your regular sailor pool. Conversely, with the Royal Navy, obviously the Royal Navy's been around a little bit longer than the US Navy. And as a result, they have a very, very, very large pool of people who accomplish something notable for them to draw on. And at that point, even if you select down to, let's say, captain and above, you still have an absolutely colossal pool to draw on. And that's before you get into the fact that some people you can style in multiple different ways. So, for example, you can have an HMS Jervis and an HMS St. Vincent. They actually refer to the same person. And it gets worse, ironically enough, when you get over to land-based people, because you can have an HMS Duke of Wellington, an HMS Iron Duke, and an HMS Wellesley, and they all refer to the same person. The flip side to that, of course, is you can have an HMS Hood, but there's half a dozen people from the Hood family for which the ship could be named. And then factor on top of that, that generally it tends to be the capital ships that get the people names. So you've got a, relatively speaking, small pool of ships, a very large pool of higher rank officers who did really famous things. And the common man tends to get frozen out until the time of destroyers. But then destroyers take up the names of sloops and brigs and small frigates and so forth, which already have a very well-established history in which they want to repeat. But that's where you get, you know, ships like the Broke, after Captain Broke, the guy who beat USS Chesapeake and so forth. They do occur, but they're scattered in with lots of destroyer names. And half the time, because those names are also place names and or battle names and so forth, it tends to get a little bit overlooked. Second, on the subject of ships named for monarchs, why aren't we there more ships named for famous historic sovereigns? In addition to the Queen Elizabeth, we could have had a King William I, Richard I, Edward III, or Henry V, etc., etc. That's because, with a very, very few exceptions, like the King Alfred, the tradition for using royal names in the Royal Navy has been that the first capital ship built during the reign of the monarch should carry the name of that monarch. So there isn't a huge amount of reaching back in time for historical monarch names, because the monarchical name tradition is supposed to be for the current one, except for right at the end of the period the Channel covers and into the modern day, because of all the kerfuffle with Edward VIII and then King George V. What should have been King Edward VIII was then, by tradition, supposed to become King George VI, because she wasn't launched and therefore wasn't yet named before Edward VIII abdicated. But because of all the tensions running around the abdication, King George VI decided, actually, we're going to take a step back one and rename the ship again to King George V, which is why you have, in very short order, two King George V classes in the Royal Navy, the one from World War I, which is following the actual tradition, and then the one from World War II, which is starting a new one-step-back tradition. Now, the slightly odd thing is that then, in theory, when Britain built another capital ship, we should have then named it King George VI in the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, except there seems to have been some disagreement on to what exactly constituted a capital ship. And also, you know, we ended up not actually building any aircraft carriers for a good long time during Queen Elizabeth II's reign, and certainly no big fleet carriers. So the ballistic missile subs got more traditional battleship names. And whether or not we would have had one of the CVA-01s called King George VI, who knows? But then fast forward to the present day, and one of the Dreadnought-class nuclear missile submarines is supposed to be King George VI. But of course, we now have King Charles III, which means that in theory, for the tradition to catch up, we should rename one of the other ballistic missile subs Queen Elizabeth II. So we're still one generation back. Except, of course, we also have the aircraft carrier HMS Queen Elizabeth, which is carrying the name not of the recently departed Queen Elizabeth II, but in fact is carrying on the name of the battleship HMS Queen Elizabeth of the Queen Elizabeth class, which is why the second ship is Prince of Wales, which is also obviously carrying on a battleship name. And I think having a carrier called Queen Elizabeth and a ballistic missile sub called Queen Elizabeth II at the same time would be incredibly confusing for everyone. And then third, why wasn't there ever an HMS Golden Hind named after Drake's ship? Well, technically there was a stone frigate called HMS Golden Hind at one point, but with the aforementioned reference, you know, to Queen Elizabeth and Queen Elizabeth II potentially being confusing at the same time, the Royal Navy generally tries to steer away from names that could be confused with each other. So Golden Hind, although obviously very prestigious in British naval annals, was a private vessel. It wasn't a royal vessel or a vessel of the Royal Navy when it did its circumnavigation. So technically it didn't establish any particular tradition within the Royal Navy, but there is a kind of a backhanded way of acknowledging it, in that there have been Hinds, not Golden Hinds, but just Hinds, which have been in service with the Royal Navy quite a lot. So if you look at the list of ships named HMS Hind, there's been something between 15 and 18 Hinds in the Royal Navy. It just depends on whether you count from the period when they're officially HMS Hind or whether they're just the Royal Navy ship Hind, because like Mary Rose was not HMS Mary Rose because they weren't using HMS at that point, but she's still a ship of the Royal Navy. Epic Redeemer asks, besides the Deutschlands, what other plans for ships did the Reichsmarine have? Their plans were relatively limited, mainly because Weimar Germany was still ostensibly following the restrictions of the Treaty of Versailles. Now, that didn't mean they were completely compliant, because the historic, you know, ship all the U-boat designers over to the Netherlands and hope they keep their hand in was a program that was actually undertaken during the Weimar period. But in terms of actual ships built, there were limits to what they could do. And of course, it's not helped by the fact that some of the programs essentially ran straight into the Nazi period. So there's not kind of an abandoned plan that they were planning on doing that then got given over when it became the Kriegsmarine. But the Reichsmarine did also give us things like the Königsbergs and the Leipzigs, you can see here. But ostensibly, Germany was allowed six vessels of the 10,000-ton pre-dreadnought replacement class. So you had the Deutschlands, and in theory, had the Weimar Republic and the Reichsmarine continued, you would have had three additional improved Deutschlands to replace Schleswig-Holstein and Schleswig-Holstein, and the one that they were using purely as a training ship. So that would have given you six related ships in two semi-separate classes, but obviously the building of the Graf Spee, the final one of the Deutschlands, runs right into the election of Hitler, so you then have a brief abortive look at an expanded Deutschland class, as in the design itself is expanded to be a larger ship, and that evolves into being the Scharnhorst class. Robert Henry Ilston asks, whaleback versus Atlantic versus whatever other kinds of bows, what are the differences, visual, and the pros and cons of the various types? Okay, brief but non-exhaustive list for warships. Whaleback, very good at shedding water, but honestly also very good at getting water over in the first place, so generally pretty terrible for anything that is of any substantial size. And even on really small stuff, you know, stuff that's a couple of dozen, maybe a couple of hundred tons, only really practical if you intend to drive that thing at high speed. Atlantic bow, as seen here with the Scharnhorsts, a very flared, very heavily raked bow, i.e. it has a bit of an upward curve to it. This is designed to improve seakeeping by increasing your freeboard forward, so making it less likely that water's going to come over the top simply just by being quite high. And the quite wide flare means that if water does get up that high on the bow, it should in theory be deflected outwards. So good advantages for seakeeping generally. Disadvantages are a fairly large amount of deck area up front, up top, which means if you do go underwater, there's quite a bit of scooping going on. And because you need quite a wide continuous flare in order to be effective, it can also mean that your bow can weigh a little bit more than you might otherwise want it to. Then you have a knuckle or trawler bow, which you see most commonly on the British town-class cruisers, and that's an attempt to take the Atlantic or Clipper, whatever you want to call it, the flared bow, and get most of the benefits while getting rid of some of the drawbacks. And what that effectively does is it starts off with the flare, but then when you get up to essentially the last but one, possibly last but two deck level, depending on the scale of the ship and exactly where you're putting it, instead of continuing to flare out, you have a very, very sharp flare initially, and then you just build vertically straight up. Now, that obviously reduces your overall deck area up top, so scooping becomes somewhat less of an issue. You still get most of the deflection purposes or from the flaring of the hull lower down, and it actually makes storing things in the bow somewhat easier because you have a more regular shape rather than this very complex 3D shape, which you do with the Atlantic or Clipper style bow. Disadvantages are weight and also a kind of catch-22 situation in that it creates quite a lot of bow volume high up, which can be really good for keeping the ship's nose out of the water and popping up quite quickly if you do get submerged, but it also means if that area takes damage, there's actually quite a substantial volume to fill, which could weigh you down. Another quite famous one, which you'll see especially on French armoured cruisers and occasionally French battleships as well of the 1880s and 1890s, is the inverted bow. So instead of the top part of the bow being much further forward than the waterline part of the bow, it flips around. So now the shortest, furthest back element of the bow is right up top, and it slopes downwards and forwards and continues on often underwater to form some kind of projection, which in the 19th century would also very often incorporate some kind of strengthening for ramming. But the purpose of the inverted bow, unless it was very specifically coded for ramming, was, particularly towards the very end of the 19th century, a way to try and cheat your way around the issue of speed. Because speed is very closely related to your length to breadth ratio, which is specifically your waterline length. But of course, any kind of extended bow adds more weight, both generally and specifically towards the end of the ship. So the idea of an inverted bow is that you can keep your actual main bow structure, and thus the bit that's actually contributing a fair bit of weight, further back. But by sticking out this relatively long, relatively thin structure in the inverted bow ahead and into the water, you're actually artificially increasing your waterline length without all the associated weight up top, thus giving you the speed advantages of a longer hull without most of the weight penalties. The disadvantage of this is it also gives a natural slope for the water to come up, so past certain speeds you're essentially sluicing water onto yourself. And there's a few other bows, but I think that's all we've got time for this particular time round. Nathapron Hongsheron asks, how did Nagato end up so much better than in design than the Ersatz Yorks, despite being similar in size and design date? Just under a knot slower in speed, but traded for a significantly more powerful gun and better armor coverage. So there are two big savings with the Nagato class as compared to the Mackensons, which will help to explain things. I mean, there are a lot of other factors as well, including the fact that the Nagatos are ultimately somewhat heavier than the Mackensons, so they do have a bit more displacement to put into things, so you'd expect them to have some advantage. But one of the big advantages the Nagatos have is they adopt the all-or-nothing armor scheme, which means that although both ships have a roughly similar level thickness of belt armor, when it comes to, as you mentioned, how much you can cover with that belt armor and also thickness of deck armor and so forth, because the Nagato class put almost every single pound or kilo of armor weight into that central all-or-nothing citadel, they can actually get the same level of coverage over the citadel as you get on the Mackensons for considerably less weight, because you've eliminated all the outlying partial armor. And the other big factor, as I said, there are a bunch of other smaller ones, but the other big one is machinery. And that actually has several compounded factors built into it. Firstly, yes, although the Nagato is only a little bit slower than the Mackensen, because it is supposed to be going a little bit slower, it doesn't need as much power. If it doesn't need as much power, then it doesn't need quite as large a machinery plant in the first place. So you're saving weight and space by having a slightly smaller, slightly less powerful machinery plant. On top of that, Nagato and Mutsu, obviously, are using a power plant that is initially mostly oil-fired with some partial coal firing, whereas the Mackensons are using mostly coal firing with some partial oil firing. And oil firing allows you to use a much more efficient, in terms of weight and space, boiler plant. You look at the Revenge class, for instance, initially planned to be coal-powered with oil spray, and they were going to do 21 knots, and then they convert them mid-design to oil spraying. So almost everything else about the Revenges is the same, just the fact they've switched over to oil propulsion, and it saves enough weight and generates more power with that reduced weight that they actually hit around 23 knots, at least by design. Admittedly, on the speed trials, they tend to make around 22, but that's still an increase of at least a knot over their coal-fired iteration, assuming that under the coal-fired iteration they would have made 21, and given that the speed difference we're talking about between Nagato and Mackensen is only a fraction more than a knot, you can kind of see the difference just from that. But then you compound these two factors together. So Mackensen needs more power from less efficient boilers, which take up more weight and space, and therefore Mackensen's machinery plant is going to be considerably larger and considerably heavier than that of Nagato's, despite the overall relative closeness in power output and speed, and thus every inch of space and every kilo or pound of weight that's saved is something that Nagato can put into other things. And related to that fuel issue as a final sort of pièce de résistance in terms of major factors, the Mackensons were designed to go considerably further than the Nagatos, and so their all-up fuel weight is about 1,000 tons more than the Nagatos. And bearing in mind that the Nagatos already have, you know, about 1,500 tons or so additional displacement to play with, factor in that additional fuel weight, and suddenly the Nagatos have a lot of additional weight to play with, apart from the machinery space and armor efficiencies we've already discussed. And finally for this week, Captain Oblivious asks, I read several lengthy articles on US floatplane operations and several accounts of US World War II floatplane pilots. A couple of pilots said what scared them the most was a cross-deck launch. I thought recovery would be the riskiest activity, depending on the seas. They stated that the charge used to fire the catapult was unreliable, and if weak, the float could catch on the far side railing and flip the plane into the drink. Several other articles said they used an empty 5-inch cartridge filled with a bag of cordite. What was used, or did it vary by time and or vessel? Is it basically a blank 300-gram bag of cordite with a minimal seal? And was the unreliability due to the variability of the charge, a design weakness in the catapult, or both? The standard charge used for launching US catapult floatplanes was actually black powder, not cordite. Using cordite wouldn't make a huge amount of sense because it would be pretty much the only place you'd have cordite used in the entire US Navy. Whereas black powder had obviously a very long history with the US Navy and still had a history with the US Navy at that point, being used as things like the primer charges for the main charges on battleship guns and so forth. There was also an air compressor, so compressed air type catapult that was available on some ships because they experimented with both systems as well as flywheel and other types of systems. But eventually it was decided that the gunpowder based one was the better one. So if you're looking at the listings of equipment on US ships and you see that it has a P type catapult, or the catapult anywhere in its designation has the letter P, that's a black powder catapult, whereas if you see that it's a type A catapult, that's an air compression catapult. And I mean, if you see any other letters, then you've got one of the weird experimental ones, but you should normally see a very few type A catapults on older ships and mostly different variations on the type P, the P6, for example, being the one that would be used on US fast battleships. Now, as far as the charge went, it wasn't just a case of taking a standard 5-inch charge and sticking that in. That would have far too much power. You'd end up blowing the plane up or blowing up the catapult, or possibly, if assuming everything else held together, firing the plane off at a ridiculous speed. So it was a fairly reduced charge in the cartridge case, but it also had to be specially shaped to fit, because it wasn't a case of fire off the charge and everything gets catapulted forward like you would if you were a shell out of a gun. What you had was a very, very strong gas chamber for the expansion of the gases from the combustion, and then this was then let out into the catapult system through a series of nozzles. So you got a very quick, relatively speaking, ignition and high pressure hot gases, but then this was allowed to feed out over time, obviously this is all relatively speaking, in order to accelerate the aircraft with a great deal of force over a relatively long distance without snapping the pilot's neck or making them black out. The problem, of course, is that, well, you're having to essentially hand make each charge. I mean, they're not making them up on the spot, but still, there is going to be a certain amount of variation when you're trying to make literal donuts of black powder. Plus, of course, black powder is a little bit more sensitive to damp than some other forms of explosive, and it's only tamped on over by a cork seal, so there's more opportunities for water intrusion, so all of this could affect how well the black powder burns or doesn't. Plus, of course, black powder fouls things, something rotten. So bearing in mind that the force has to vent out of these nozzles into the rest of the catapult system, if the system has been used quite a bit, it's possible there'll be fouling, so you won't get as much of the gas being released. Therefore, you'll get a soft launch. It's also possible that, you know, given the location of the catapults on some airships, like you can see here on the fantail, that you might have rust, and builds up of rust, A, will very slightly narrow the nozzles and obviously provide a lot more surface area for rapid fouling buildup. So that could give you a soft launch as well. And you could just get bad luck, because remember, the ship is going to be pitching and rolling all the time. So what might be just about the right level of force to get you kicked off, if the ship is at just the right angle, if, let's say, the aircraft is pointing, relatively speaking, quite up because the ship's, I don't know, rolled by 20 degrees in the wrong direction just at the moment the charge goes off, then you've wasted a lot of the energy fighting gravity, and by the time the ship comes level or points down, you just haven't got the acceleration left in the distance you have left in order to get up to speed. So there's a few potential issues with the system, but in theory, as long as you keep it all relatively clean and so forth, then you should be okay. But there's always bad luck. And that brings us to the end of this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I hope to see you again in another episode fairly soon. Bye for now.